My name is Michelle Blacksmith. I am doing an oral history with Beth Lazar. Today's date is Thursday, December 1st, 2022. For the record, Beth, would you state your full name, age, and the city or a town in which you live?
My name is Beth Lazar. I live in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and I am 65 years old.
Okay. So Beth, I'm going to start off first by asking you, where were you born?
I was born in Philadelphia, PA, and I would call my family a blended family because my mother died when I was 4 years old, and her and my father had three children, my older brother, me, and my younger sister, Karen. And after she passed away, me and my sister went to live with our cousins, and my brother lived with my grandmother, and that was for about a year and a half. And then my father remarried, took the three of us and his new wife and moved to Connecticut. And with his new wife, who is my stepmother, but I consider her my mother because she raised me since I was like 5 years old, he had four more children. So I consider them my full brothers and sisters, even though we come from different mothers, we all have the same father.
So just to do the math, how many siblings do you have altogether?
I have four sisters and two brothers. There's seven kids altogether.
Now, was there any time when all of you were living in the same home?
No, because there's such a age span. My baby sister is 15 years younger than me, which would I have an older brother who's 3 years older than me. So he was 18 when she was born and he was away at college.
Do you have any memories of your biological mother?
I just remember her when she was sick. She had pneumonia and her lungs filled up with water, and at that time they just were experimenting with a procedure to pump out water from lungs. They didn't use that procedure on my mother, but Elizabeth Taylor the same year had the same thing happen to her, and they pumped out her lungs and she lived, but they didn't do that for my mother.
What were your father's name and your mother's maiden name?
My father is Leonard Moisha Lazar. My birth mother was Shirley Greenberg, and then when she married, Lazar.
Okay, thank you. So I'm curious, why did your father move to Connecticut and when did that happen?
That happened, I think, in 1962. He got a job at United Aircraft in Windsor Locks, Connecticut. And so basically he moved for the job, and also he wanted to start fresh, you know, because there were sad memories in Philadelphia, and he wanted to start fresh with this new family.
So did you say that you were about five when your dad remarried and the family was brought together and then you moved to Connecticut? Tell me about your childhood in Connecticut.
Well, when we left Philadelphia, you know, like I said, I was living with my cousins, and my older cousin, he was a real brat. He told us that there were lions and tigers and bears in Connecticut, and that if we didn't get eaten by the lions and tigers and bears, we'd be buried in snow. So I was scared out of my wits to come to Connecticut. And luckily there were no lions and tigers and bears, but at that time the snow was so high it did almost go over my head.
Okay. Tell me some other childhood memories. Okay, first of all, how many children were in the house when you were growing up?
Seven for most of it in Connecticut.
In Connecticut.
Okay. But then when my brother went away to college, there were six of us children and two parents. And we lived in this rural town. It's kind of built up now, but it was real rural when we moved in East Granby, Connecticut. There were more cows than people. In my class, the class of 1975, there were a total of 46 people. And even though it was a public school, we got such a great education. It was like a private school. We had art, we had music, our biology labs were well equipped. We were very privileged, and there was a lot of trees and meadows and open space and everything.
Now, you said that your father worked for a company in Windsor Locks, so were other families associated with the same company as your dad?
I don't know. I know our neighbors, father worked in construction, and on the other side, the neighbor, the father didn't work, and the mother worked for insurance companies in Hartford.
What are some of the fondest memories of your childhood? Think back to some of the things that make you the happiest to go back and reflect upon.
Well, we had in our school system a man named Mr. Bruno, and he developed the whole music program for the whole school system of East Granby. He had music class where he would play an accordion and get us singing. In elementary school, and in the high school, he started the high school band, and he taught every single student in the band how to play their instrument, and we played at UConn at halftime in the fall. He also started a jazz band as an offshoot of the high school band. And I'm still friends with the people who were in the band with me. I played saxophone, and the guy who played saxophone next to me, he was in a younger grade, but we're still friends to this day.
Now, I happen to know from personal experience that you are a music lover. Do you still play the saxophone?
No, I haven't played since high school.
Mm-hmm. Did you play in the jazz band?
Yes, I did. And the regular band, which we played concerts, and we were also a marching band. Like I said, we played at halftime at the UConn football games.
Now, did you go to school past high school?
Yes, I went to UConn. And at UConn, two major things happened that kind of shaped the rest of my life. I met up with a woman named Linda Smith who taught me radio. And back then, you needed a license to be on the radio. And she trained me to pass the test, and she also trained me in how to run a radio program, you know, how to run the equipment and stuff. And she started the woman's department, the woman affairs department at the Yukon radio station. And she taught me a lot about women's rights and women's health and women's issues. The other thing on campus was this kind of radical group. They were Marxist. And I got involved with them, and like we went down to Washington. At that time, there was a case up before the Supreme Court, Bakke. He was against affirmative action. He thought it was reverse discrimination. And we were against Bakke, and we wanted to educate people about why he was so wrong and why there's a need for affirmative action. And there was a mass march on Washington called Beat Back Bakke, and we organized a couple busloads to go down. And we also, in Tupelo, Mississippi, the Klan was pushing black farmers off their land by terrorizing them, and also saying, since most of the black farmers, it was a family farm, that they got, you know, many, many years ago, like over 100 years ago, after the Civil War, and they didn't have papers. And so the Klan used that to say they really didn't own the land and everything. And they had asked for people to come and support the black farmers. And we went down to Tupelo, Mississippi with a busload to go for a march there.
So what year was this?
This must have been 1976.
So, is there anything else that you would like to tell me about your time period at UConn? Anything that I might not have asked?
No, I think that just that. Oh, I went to China. The group that I was involved with, the Chinese government invited us over, and the Chinese government was a lot different than it is now. Now it's nearly fascist. But this was like soon after the revolution and stuff, and it was still progressive. And so they invited us over, and we got to see the countryside and their women's groups and their minority groups and stuff like that.
And how long were you there?
I think for a month. Yeah.
So let's move ahead to when you came to Bridgeport. So if my understanding is correct, you came to Bridgeport in 1980. So I'm curious as to why.
I came to Bridgeport in 1980 because I had a job with something called Economics Rights Organization. I was going to be a community organizer, and I paid my last penny to get an apartment on Sheridan Street, which was a horrible apartment, but it cost so much. But when I got here, like the local people were saying they didn't agree with the policies of the organization, and I just sided with the community and I quit the job. So I was here in Bridgeport having spent my last penny on this horrible apartment. It didn't have a refrigerator. It didn't have a working stove. And it was infested with roaches. And at first I thought I'm cursed. But it really turned out to be a blessing because I met some of the most beautiful people who are friends with me still to today, the ones that are still alive. And I'm glad I came to Bridgeport. And how I got work, I met up with Mrs. Norris. She was the president of the Father Panic Tenants Association, and she wanted to hire me to work in their summer day camp, which I got paid through ABCD, and I was really taken aback that what they considered a summer camp was having the children in a school, Waltersville School, which was in the middle of Father Panic, and there's no trees or anything around there. We did our exercises and played games on a blacktop, and we held classes inside the school, and I didn't think that was much of a summer for kids, but I guess that's all they had available in the city. So I, and at the summer camp, I'd say 95% of the people, the staff and the children, were Black, African American, and there was a handful of Hispanics, and I was the only white person. Mm-hmm.
And so how was that experience for you?
Well, it made me realize how privileged I was as a child growing up in East Granby, that I had, you know, trees and grass and meadows to run around in and play in and stuff.
So now, once the summer job ended, or summer camp, what did you do next?
I worked at Sears, unloading trucks in their, Sears had a catalog section where people would order stuff and they'd bring it to the store, and you go like under the store and there was this area where they kept packages and stuff, and we would unload the trucks, and also when people came to pick up stuff, we'd bring the stuff out to their car. And I was the only woman in that department, and Herbie Mack, did you ever hear of him?
No.
He was a police officer when he grew up. At that time, he was in high school, and that was like his summer job and his after-school job. And I was also taking courses at Housatonic because I'm interested in education. And I was taking a course on the Constitution and the law, and he wanted to be a policeman. So I was sharing my textbooks with them and telling them what I was learning in class. And years later, about 4 or 5 years later, he became a Bridgeport policeman, and he's the one that was on the horse all the time outside the arena and in downtown Bridgeport. Yeah, he passed away a couple years ago, but that's where I met him. And also, I also taught at nighttime adult ed, English as a second language.
Can we go back for a minute and just talk about Sears? I'm curious to know what it was like for you being the only woman on the job.
Well, the only other position to like work in the store was to work as a sales clerk, and you had to wear a dress and nylons and everything, and I just wasn't into that. And so I really wanted to work in the that department, the I don't know what they called it, I forget, but the package department.
Do you feel like you received equal or fair treatment from the men with whom you worked?
Oh yeah, they were younger than me, 'cause I was in my 20s, and most of them were high school kids who it was their like after school summer employment job.
So how long did you stay at Sears?
Well, I was in Bridgeport from 80 to 81, and then I left, and I came back later. But that year, 80 to 81, really changed my life in that I met up with this coalition. It was called the Vieques Support Committee. And Willie Matos was in it. He used to be one of the Young Lords, Cesar Battaglia, who was worked for the gas company, but he was really a community activist. He was like our inside person. And Ani Mendez and Bonnie Perez and Victor Matos and Andy Piasek. They not only supported that the U.S. should get out of Vieques, Puerto Rico, because at that time the U.S. was using this island that was Puerto Rico as a bombing exercise, and there were farmers and people who lived there. And they also got involved with local politics, and they were talking about at that time of knocking down Father Panic, but they didn't have any plans on where they were going to put the people if they knocked it down. And so there was a lot of protest about that. And there was also protest about, you know, Washington Park?
Yes,
on the east side?
I do.
When it was real hot, the kids would open up the fire hydrants and play in the water, and the police told the kids not to do it. And there was this 14-year-old boy named Tito who opened it up, and so they shot and killed him. And the press tried to make it look like Tito was this horrible kid. All they did was talk about that he missed a lot of school, he got bad grades, like that's an excuse to kill someone. And so that had happened before I got to Bridgeport, but people were still organizing to try to get the policeman who had done that fired and stuff. And so during the Barnum Festival parade, every year Bridgeport has something called the Barnum Festival parade right around the end of June, the beginning of July, because P.T. Barnum's birthday was the 4th of July. And he was from Bridgeport, so they have a parade in his memory, and it's a big deal in Bridgeport. And what this coalition did was they inserted themselves into the parade with protest signs. And we had planned out ahead of time that some of us would be willing to get arrested. And so like three people sat down and refused to get up when the police came to tell us to, you know, move out of the way. And they got arrested. The rest of us went down to the police station and bailed them out. And they finally, they didn't, they dropped all charges and everything. But I don't know if it made the papers or not. I don't remember. But
that sounds like something for us to research.
Yeah. And what else happened that year?
Well, you mentioned that you moved away or went away from Bridgeport for a year. And then came back. Is that right?
Yeah. Also in 1980 to 1981, I did a radio show at a local radio station, and it was a woman show. And this woman called up the station. Her name was Kathy Lewis, and she said, "That's not woman's music." And I said, "What do you mean?" I was playing Billie Holiday, Carole King, music like that. And she said, "Women's music is music by women on women-owned record labels. And it's about women." And she offered to bring me to Bloodroot, which I didn't know anything about. And Bloodroot is a feminist vegetarian restaurant that is run and owned by all women. And in the back room, they have a woman's bookstore with books by and about women, and also records by and about women. And she turned me on to the woman's music scene, which is like Holly Near, Chris Williams, Meg Christian, and I bought my first women's music there at Bloodroot. And also at Bloodroot, they had on Wednesday night, they said they were closed, but really they were open for the Goody B. Knapp Society, which was a group of women. They named themselves after Goody B. Knapp, who was a woman who lived in Black Rock in the 1800s, who was accused of being a witch and drowned in Black Rock. And this group of women who met were mostly gay women. And back in 1980, being gay was hush hush. People weren't open about it, so it was kind of like this secret society. And on Wednesday night, Kathy invited me. They would gather at Bloodroot and have dinner together. And back then, dinner at Bloodroot was $8, which at the time seemed like a lot, but today, by today's standards, is very good. And you would get soup, salad, bread, coffee, and your choice of dessert for $8, which was pretty good.
That's great. Wish I could find that now. I have a question for you as an aside, as you're talking about women and women's music and women's labels. I don't know that owning a women's label applies, but I'm curious as to when you discovered Nina Simone.
Oh, I discovered Nina Simone as an undergrad because when I was at UConn in 1975, and I met up with Linda Smith, and I was at the record library as part of the radio station. I came across her music and I really liked it.
Okay. So, what next?
Well, what happened was,
After the radio station with the woman's theme, what came up next for you?
well, I got some money to go back to UConn to get a master's. And so I took advantage of that and went to back to UConn from 1982 to 1984. And since I my experience in Bridgeport with the Latino community and learning about Vieques and stuff, I got interested in Latin America, and that became my focus of my anthropology studies. And during my time when I was getting my master's, Linda Smith wanted to leave the radio station, and she asked that I take over as woman affairs director at the UConn radio station, and I did. And
And what were the call letters of that station?
WHUS. And Wednesday night was Woman's Night. It began from 6 to 7, was a documentary that I made each week about women, either women's history or women's accomplishments or something about women. And then 7 to 10 was women's music. There were other women in the collective. It was the Women's Radio Collective who ran Wednesday night. There was about two or three women DJs who ran that. And then from 10 to 10:30 was something called Woman's Space, which was women's news, anything in the news applying to women. And then from 10:30 to 2 a.m. in the morning, I did an R&B show. So Wednesday night was a big night for me during college. And also, as part of the Women's Affairs role, we were also in charge of children's programming. And at Summers Prison, they had a program where the men created a weekly children's program called the Cabbage Patch. And I would go up there like once a month and help them do that. They would give us a tape of it and we'd play it.
And now, did you mention being a news director as well, or news affairs?
No,
It was the women's affairs.
it was the woman's affairs director.
Women's affairs director. Okay. And it sounds like you did a lot of work for
Yeah,
that, you know, to keep that program running.
and the other thing I did on my own, since I was studying about Latin America, I had a, it was almost weekly, 1 hour show about Latin America.
So, what did you do once you got your degree, your master's degree?
Well, what happened was in December of 1984, I had finished all my coursework, but I needed to write a thesis. But at that time, I basically had a nervous breakdown, and I ended up dropping out. And the only place when I kind of recovered, wanted to go, was back to Bridgeport. So I came back to Bridgeport and I had, because I took a lot of anthropology courses, but I also love English, I love writing, I love reading, I love literature and poetry. I had enough English classes that I could become an English teacher. All I needed to do was take two education courses. So I took two, when I got back to Bridgeport, I took two education courses at Sacred Heart University and did my student teaching at BASIC. And from there, I didn't get a full-time job, but I was like a permanent substitute for years. Like if someone went on maternity leave for 3 months, I would fill in for them. And
So you did substitute teaching, and it sounds like a number of long-term substitute assignments.
Yeah, and at night, could I get a drink of water?
Absolutely.
At night, I would teach adult ed English as a second language.
Now, would I be missing anything if I went ahead to your later career in radio? Is there anything that we need to fill in before we talk about? Is it VOF? WVOF?
VOF, right.
Okay, so before we talk about VOF, is there anything in the interim that we need to discuss that we
Oh,
haven't talked
going
about
back
already?
to my first encounter with Bridgeport, 1980 to 81,
Okay.
I also met up with this guy named James Moss. And him and another guy who was in radio, Ruben Obreo, were starting an art gallery, kind of art gallery cafe type thing called City Lights, and it was on Fairfield Avenue. There's a restaurant there now, It's right across from the Bijou Theater. But at that time, back in 1980, it was a gutted out building, and there was plaster all over and debris and everything. And they were cleaning it up and trying to fix it up to be an art gallery and also like a cafe where artists could perform and stuff. And I'm still friends with Ruben Abreu. I don't know if he's still alive, but in recent years he's had Alzheimer's or dementia. But James Moss is still around. He's also a percussionist. He makes kalimbas. Do you know what a kalimba is?
Yes, I
An
do.
African
Yes, I do.
piano, thumb piano. He makes those. He makes drums. I've had him on my show and stuff. And since then, City Lights has really come a long way. It's had two or three locations since then.
Right. Okay. Very good. So now, is this the appropriate time for us to start talking about your WVOF experience in the Unity Groove?
Oh, okay.
I don't want to miss anything. You tell me, is there something that we should be talking about before we get to that?
Oh, yes,
Okay.
yes.
Tell me.
1991 was a big year for me. And also, I think, for Bridgeport. What happened was on the east side of Bridgeport was this huge trash pile called Mount Trashmore. And also, what happened in 1991, there was the whole US cities were in crisis there economically. And Reverend Jesse Jackson had a campaign called Bail Out American Cities. And he came to Connecticut, starting in Stamford, and marched all the way to Hartford. And one of his stops was Bridgeport. And when he came to Bridgeport, there was a service at Mount Airy Baptist Church to receive him and to kind of kick off the Bridgeport to Hartford part of the march. And I went to that service and I heard Jesse Jackson. And at that time, Mount Airy was run by Jerry Street. He was an excellent reverend, really good speaker. But also at that service was a young rabbi named Rabbi James Prosnett. And he spoke a little bit and then he read from the Torah. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. A rabbi reading at a Black Baptist church. And I want to meet this guy and I want to join his synagogue. And so I joined his synagogue and that really changed my life because, like before that, all my community activists, a lot of times before meetings, people would say a prayer and they'd always end with, in Jesus' name, or praise Jesus or something. But with my synagogue, I got very involved with social action through my synagogue, and it was just a lot more comfortable, you know.
So, do you still belong to the same synagogue?
Yes, I do.
You do. And is the rabbi still alive?
Yes, he is, but he's retired. We have two new rabbis. With some of the things that I got involved with through the synagogue, one of the synagogue members named Bobby Bressler, it's a woman, her real name's Barbara Bressler. She started an organization called Connecticut Against Gun Violence. And the reason she started it was because here in Bridgeport, there was a drive-by shooting, and one of the stray bullets went into a school bus and hit a student, you know, a young kid. And that really upset her. And so she got her women friends together over the kitchen table and started this organization, which is still around today, called Connecticut Against Gun Violence. And I got active with her and that organization through the synagogue. And one of the things we worked on was the assault weapon ban. And they succeeded in passing it in Connecticut long before it passed on the national level. And
Anything else you'd like to tell me about your involvement in activism in the synagogue?
we also worked with Habitat for Humanity and built got up the funds to build two houses here in Bridgeport. Nowadays, back then in 91 and 92, around there was an organization called Greater Bridgeport Interfaith Action. And that was like a coalition of churches and synagogues. And our synagogue belonged. And I worked with that on a lot of local issues. And nowadays, our synagogue is a member of an organization called CONNECT, Congregations Organized for a New Connecticut. And they successfully passed a clean slate law here in Connecticut so that people coming out of prison, if they stay out of prison for a certain number of years, their record will be wiped clean so they could get a job and do other things. And one thing I'm doing with my temple right now is the beginning of this year, I formed a committee called the B'nai Israel Mental Health Group. And we had a speaker at one of our Friday night services. I don't know if you know her, Randy Kay. She's on, she used to be on WPLR radio, and she's now on WSHU. But she's active with an organization called NAMI, National Alliance for Mental Illness. And she has a son has schizophrenia, and she wrote a book about that. And she recently wrote a book called Happier Made Simple. And she talked about that book and her experiences at a Friday night service. And then we had a dinner all together. Something else the group did is we went up together to Hartford to the Connecticut Historical Society, had an exhibit about mental health in Connecticut, and we went there together and learned a lot about, like, in the 1700s and early 1800s, how they dealt with mental illness is they put leeches on you to get the bad blood out, and they put people in cages in the attic and stuff like that. But that's not that different from today, because the majority of mentally ill people are in prison nowadays, so we're still putting mentally ill people in cages.
I would like to go now to your later career in radio. So can we begin talking about WVOF and your experiences there? I knew, first of all, how long were you at VOF?
I was at WVOF from 1995 to 2020.
Okay, so that's quite a bit of time. And would you tell people what WVOF stands for, or where that radio station is located?
WVOF stands for Voice of Fairfield. And it's located in the Student Center at Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. And even though I was there and did most of my radio programming there, the majority of my guests were from Bridgeport, and I have a list of some of the people I've had on my show.
Okay, would you like to share that with us?
Sure.
Okay, let's hear some of the people that you had on the show.
Steve Clark, who's a bassist and composer. James Moss, who's a percussionist and he's a vocalist too, and he makes percussion instruments. Michael Dunham, who's a jazz and blues singer. Writers Shauna Melton, Ina Anderson, Richard Fuel, Jeanette Harris. And some of the organizations that I've had on that are Bridgeport-based is Preserve Remington Woods, Bridgeport Generation Now, Bridgeport Habitat, Bridgeport School Volunteers Association, which no longer exists, Bridgeport Child Advocacy Coalition, which no longer exists, Connect, which I told you about, Congregations Organized for New Connecticut. I also had Georgia Day on. She used to have her own bookstore. It was right across from the library for a while, and then it moved over to John Street. It was called the Rainy Fay Bookstore. Excellent bookstore. And she also used to have musicians and poets come read our play at her store.
Okay, thank you. And in full disclosure, I was also on your program twice, as a matter of fact, and the last time to talk about Bridgeport Public Library's exhibition that we did, We Are Artists Everyone, The Art and Activism 1970 to 1986. I just thought that that was important to mention in the interest of full disclosure.
Yeah.
So I want you to talk with me about your time at VOF. Describe it. What did you do? What were your favorite parts of being there? What were your least favorite parts of being there?
Well, when it began, it was in the basement of a dormitory, and the equipment went back to 1950. And we also, back in 1995 through 2000, we had a teletype machine. I don't know if you know what those are. It prints the news. It's like a typewriter and computer built in one, and it would spew off pieces of paper with the news on it. And for a while there, I was doing three shows. I did my Unity Groove show. In the summer, on Monday afternoons, I would do something called Sounds of Summer, which was Broadway musicals. And I was also the news director, and I produced a weekly news program. And so I used the teletype a lot.
Yeah, you wore quite a few hats.
Yeah.
How did you come up with the name Unity Groove?
There's this woman saxophonist, jazz musician called Jenny Hill, and she had a song called Unity Groove, which is it's spoken word and the drum a lot, talking about unity, that were about music and unity and everything. And I used that as my theme song and also theme of the program. My Wednesday program called Unity Groove was basically jazz, soul, R&B, and interviews with musicians, poets, playwrights, community activists, and whoever else.
And you weren't just called Beth. What was your, for want of a better, stage name, radio name?
Lady Beth.
Lady Beth. So I'm speaking with Lady Beth. And Lady Beth, I would like to know, how did you choose your guest for your programs?
Well, usually, like I'd go to a concert or poetry reading or a play or something, and I'd ask the playwright or the musician to come on my program.
So you went out into the public and you did your research that way
Yeah.
and brought people in. Okay. And the program ended in what year?
2020,
Now, 2020 is a significant year for
year.
all of us because, in some sense, it's the year of COVID. So
Well,
did
that's
COVID
be
have anything to do with the ending
yes.
of the program?
On March 11th, 2020, we were told that the radio was going to be closing down for 2 weeks because of this virus, and they thought if they closed down for 2 weeks, everything would be okay. And so I was on the air when they told us. So I said, I'll be back in 2 weeks. Hope everyone's safe and everything. And that was the last time.
And so, if there were an opportunity, would you go back to radio?
I don't know. I really, since I haven't been doing it for 2 years, going on 3 years, I realized how much time it took and how much work. And I kind of got used to having all this extra free time. And
So,
also, I'm 65.
what are some of the things that you're doing now that you enjoy now that you're no longer on the radio?
Well, I like making collages, and I had two of them on exhibit during the Bridgeport Art Trail. The Bridgeport Art Trail is where the whole city of Bridgeport celebrates the arts, and all the artist studios and art galleries are open, and there's musicians playing a lot of music around town. And there's also, it ends with something called Pachacacha, which is a storytelling event. Pachacacha means chit chat in Japanese, and it's a storytelling technique where you take a picture and you flash it on the screen for 20 seconds, and you take 10 pictures of your choosing and you flash them on the screen for 20 seconds each, and you utilize them to tell a story. So your story has to be synchronized with the pictures, and it has to be within this time frame. And I've done four of them now. The last one at November, I think it was 13th, at the end of the Bridgeport Art Trail. And I'm also very active with Connect through my synagogue. Congregations organized for New Connecticut. And like I said, I'm also I'm the chairperson of the B'nai Israel Mental Health Group.
So you've been a Bridgeporter since 1980. So how do you feel about your community?
I love it. I love it. But there's been big changes. One thing I forgot, which is very important, is from 1996 through 2020. Back in 1996, me and a committee of former Housatonic alumni and stuff, Housatonic Community College alumni. See, what happened is Housatonic Community College used to be on the east side of Bridgeport in the old Singer factory, Singer Sewing Factory. And back then it had a woman's center, and the head of the woman's center was Mrs. Lazarus, and she retired, and then Housatonic Community College moved downtown Bridgeport in what used to be the old Hi Ho Mall. And when they moved, they didn't make any space for a woman's center, and they didn't set aside any money to hire a woman's center director. So those of us who had gone to Housatonic Community College at some point, and some of the current students, got together a petition to petition the administration, saying you have to set aside a room and money for a woman's center. And they finally said, we'll give you a room if you prove you could put on programming. So without a budget, without a room, without a director, we put on some programming. And they finally gave us a room, but they didn't give us a director. But one of the counselors at the college, her name's Linda Wolfson, she's a beautiful person, took over on a volunteer basis. She was a counselor being paid, and on her own time, she worked with the Woman's Center and really organized it and everything. And I did some programming through them too. I got the poet laureate Marilyn Vonjak. I guess her maiden name is Marilyn Nelson. I had had her as a professor up at UConn, and I loved her, and she's such a good poet. I wrote a grant and got some money and had her come and speak at Housatonic Community College Women's Center. I had Jeanette Harris and Ina Anderson speak at the college. Just different people I got to come to the college, and Linda Wolfson got some people to come to the college and stuff. But we put on more programming than any department at the college. And finally, in 2020, Linda Wolfson retired, but also around that same time, they hired a male center director. And we said, that's discrimination that you have someone hired full time for a male center and you're not doing anything for the women. So they hired a woman center director.
Okay, so there is a woman center director now.
Now,
Now. Okay. So I have another question for you concerning Bridgeport. Do you envision living in Bridgeport for the rest of your life?
yes, unless, maybe my health or something takes me out.
So Bridgeport is your home. So before we end this interview, I'd like to know, is there anything you would like to say that we haven't discussed yet?
Well, I'd like to mark down changes that I've seen on Main Street. When I came to Bridgeport in 1980, downtown Bridgeport had a Sears, a Reed's, a Rite Aid, a H.L. Green, Ethical Pharmacy, Davidson Fabrics, the Hy-Ho Mall. And also, there was a lot of pedestrian traffic, and it was predominantly African American people. Now, downtown Main Street is deserted most times. It looks like a ghost town. And my building, which when I moved in, it was like 90% African American. It's now 90% Hispanic or Latino. I'm not sure what the correct name is. And also, the mall, the Hy-Ho Mall, is now Housatonic Community College. And Sears, where I used to work, is now also part of Housatonic Community College. And also, Bassett High School is going to move down near Seaside Park on part of the UB campus.
Right. What do you think of that?
I think it's good for the high school because they could use the park for their sports teams, and it's just a lot better area.
Anything else?
Back in the 1980s, Tisdale was running. He was the first black American male to run for mayor, and In 2019, Marilyn Moore ran, and it's been a long time, and we still don't have a black mayor.
You've made an important observation. Anything else that you would like to add before we wrap up?
I wish that Testa didn't run the Democratic Party in Bridgeport. I don't know if I should say that or you should wipe that out.
Beth Lazar, it has been a pleasure speaking with you this afternoon. Thank you for your interview.
Thank you.
Thursday, December 1st, 2022, continuing the interview with Beth Lazar. Beth, there's an organization that you want to talk about that you were a part of in the 1990s, I believe.
Yes. Since I had taught in the Bridgeport schools, basically at BASIC, I became very aware of how little Bridgeport students had. They had to share textbooks. They didn't have enough to go around. They didn't have paper or pens to give the students. When the cuts came down, a lot of times art and music was cut out. And I remember when I was a youth how important music and art was. And I had taken textbooks and paper and pencil for granted. And there was an organization in town run by Kim McLaughlin called Education First. And they fought the city and also the state to give more money for the Bridgeport Public Schools. And I became involved with that. And I think it was a very important organization. I wish it was still around because the Bridgeport school system is so underfunded.
Now we're going to talk about your siblings. We talked a little bit about them in the previous segment, but now I believe that you're going to tell me about your siblings as adults and what they do.
Yes, my older brother, he's 3 years older than me. His name is Jerry Lazar. He was on ETV. He ran a show called Extreme Close-Up, where he interviewed like Ringo Starr, Dolly Parton, just a lot of famous artists and musicians and everything. He, for a while, he was editor of different magazines. And he has a daughter named Maya. My sister, Karen, who's a year younger than me, she likes to be called Kay, K-A-Y. She was in radio for a while at CBS Radio, but now she works for the last 15 years, she's worked for the Boston Globe. And one of her pieces was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. After her comes David Lazar, and he's retired now, but he worked for the German Historical Society up until last year. He knows at least four languages. He's fluent in German, English. He knows a little Yiddish and Hebrew. I think he also knows a little French. But the German Historical Society is actually run by Germany. So even though he's stationed, the German Historical Society of America is located in Washington, D.C., his paycheck came from the German government. And Germany is very generous in their vacations. Over in Europe, you get a month vacation, you get all these sick days, and also, since you're working in America, you get American holidays off. After him is Nina. Her married name is Burnett. She worked for the FBI for, I'd say, about 10 years. And then she had two daughters, and she didn't feel she could be a good mother and work for the FBI at the same time. So she took off time to be a full-time mother. Now she works for insurance companies investigating fraud. And Sarah Lazar, she's a scientist and she studied meditation. What she did was she took people who didn't meditate and took pictures of their brain. And then she took a group that didn't meditate and took pictures of their brain also, but had that second group start meditating every day for 9 months. And then she came back and took pictures of both groups' brains. And the group that had meditated every day for 9 months, a part of their brain had actually grown. And her findings are written up in medical journals around the world. And she's been on, what's his name? Alan Alda. He had a science show on PBS. She's been on his show. She's met the Dalai Lama. She's asked around the world and by meditation groups, by scientific groups. Sometimes movie stars want to talk to her about meditating. So she's traveled all over the world with her findings. And then the baby of the family is Ridey, and she's in education. She's been a principal of a private girls' high school in Boston. She recently quit that job and is in New York City now, and she's working for a nonprofit that searches out low-income students that are doing very well to like mentor them and prepare them and help them get into college and follow them through college and then try to help them get a job after college. I don't know the name of the organization. I'm sorry.
Is there anyone else?
I'd just like to talk about my dad. He got a full scholarship to go to Temple University when he was young, And he got married very young to my biological mother. And he wanted to be a math teacher, but he realized the pay for a math teacher was so low that he had to find something else if he was going to have a family. And he saw an ad in the paper about getting involved with this new thing called computers. And at that time, computers took up a whole room, and they had something called punch cards and stuff. And he got in on the ground floor, and he went on and he worked at United Aircraft and Pratt & Whitney and everything. And he didn't make much money off it, but it was my favorite part of him. He was a magician, and he would do magic shows for all us kids' birthdays, which made us very popular because everyone wanted to come to our birthday parties to see my father perform. And he was just a really good guy. And my mom, my stepmom, she was a stay-at-home mom until we were in high school. And then she got her accountant's degree or certificate or whatever you get. And she went back to work as an accountant. And she also ran in our hometown of East Granby as the treasurer of the town. And my father was on the board of education in the town of East Granby.
Thank you. Okay. Beth Lazar, that completes our interview. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.